Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Gitarita chayena pi bhakti bhavena chetasa vedashastra puranani tena nitani sarvashaha.
For those who study the Bhagavad Gita as it is with great faith and devotion, the essence of all Vedic knowledge is revealed. So this evening, I want to read from a different verse, from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Text number 29. I want to read this verse because I'm amazed. So,
Acharya vat pashyati kaschiddenam Ascharya vat varati tataiva chanya Ascharya vat chainam anyashanoti Shutvapyenam veda na chayva kashchit.
Please repeat. Ascharyavat.
As amazing.
Pashyati.
Sees.
Kashchit.
Someone.
Enam.
This soul.
Ascharyavat.
As amazing.
Varati.
Speaks of.
Tata,
thus,
Eva,
certainly,
Cha,
also,
Anya,
another,
Ashcharyavat,
similarly amazing,
Cha,
also,
Enam,
this soul,
Anya,
another,
Shrinoti,
hears of,
Shrutva,
having heard,
api,
even,
enam,
this soul,
beda,
knows,
na,
never,
cha,
and,
eva,
certainly,
kashchit,
someone.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada,
Ki Jai.
Some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. Purport. Since Gita Upanishad is largely based on the principles of the Upanishads, it is not surprising to also find this passage in the Katha Upanishad 1.2.7. Shravanyapi bahubir yo na labhya shrinvato api bahavo yam na vidyu ashcharyo vakta kushalo sya labdha ashcharyo sya gyata kushala nunishtaha. The fact that the atomic soul is within the body of a gigantic animal, in the body of a gigantic banyan tree, and also in the microbic germs, millions and billions of which occupy only an inch of space, is certainly very amazing. Men with a poor fund of knowledge and men who are not austere cannot understand the wonders of the individual atomic spark of spirit, even though it is explained by the greatest authority of knowledge who imparted lessons even to Brahma, the first living being in the universe. Owing to a gross material conception of things, most men in this age cannot imagine how such a small particle can become both so great and so small. So men look at the soul proper as wonderful, either by constitution or by description. Illusioned by the material energy, people are so engrossed in subject matters for sense gratification that they have very little time to understand the question of self-understanding, even though it is a fact that without this self-understanding, all activities result in ultimate defeat in the struggle for existence. Perhaps they have no idea that one must think of the soul and thus make a solution to the material miseries. Some people who are inclined to hear about the soul may be attending lectures in good association, but sometimes Owing to ignorance, they are misguided by acceptance of the super soul and the atomic soul as one, without distinction of magnitude. It is very difficult to find a man who perfectly understands the position of the super soul, the atomic soul, their respective functions and relationships, and all other major and minor details. And it is still more difficult to find a man who has actually derived full benefit from knowledge of the soul, and who is able to describe the position of the soul in different aspects. But if, somehow or other, one is able to understand the subject matter of the soul, then one's life is successful. The easiest process for understanding the subject matter of self, however, is to accept the statements of the Bhagavad Gita spoken by the greatest authority, Lord Krishna, without being deviated by other theories. But it also requires a great deal of penance and sacrifice, either in this life or in the previous ones, before one is able to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna can, however, be known as such by the causeless mercy of the pure devotee and by no other way. The verse, again, is Ashcharyavat pashyati kashchid enam Ashcharyavadvarati tataiva chanya Ashcharyavat chainam anyashrinoti Shudvapyenam vedanat Chaiva kashchit. Some look on the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, and some hear of him as amazing, while others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. Mukam karoti bachilam bhangam langaya degrim yat kripa dharam mande shri gurundina taranam. So this verse and purport reminds me of Srila Prabhupada's appreciation for the Greek philosopher Socrates. Prabhupada said in the whole history of the Western civilization there was only one philosopher, Socrates, because he was Mukta Purush, he was a liberated soul. So Socrates was much appreciated by Srila Prabhupada because he was preaching Atmagyan. He was preaching this very knowledge of the soul, which is presented here in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But he was preaching to an audience in ancient Greece and Athens that was very unappreciative of this knowledge. Socrates, he made a nice comparison. He said he was being tried, he was put on trial because of his preaching. Because the Greeks then and now are very interested in sense gratification. I know because I go there to Athens, I've seen myself. So they could not appreciate. So Socrates was a very clever orator. So at his trial, he was seeming to praise the Greeks. He was saying, this city, Athens, it is like a fine horse, thoroughbred horse. And as for me, I'm like a fly biting that horse. But then he went on to point out that this was not actually a very favorable comparison. To compare human being to a horse, that is also done in the Bhagavatam. Sa eva gokara. Foolish people who think that this body made of mucus, bile, and air is the self, they are said, Saiva Gokra. They're like cow or ass or horse, you may say. And so he, that great soul like Socrates, who comes among such people and preaches the science of the real self, is not much appreciated by those who remain attached to this body and its so-called pleasures. So Socrates was put on trial, and although he made a very brilliant, not defense of himself, but defense of his teachings, he did not actually care for what they planned to do with his body, because he knew I'm not the body. So in spite of his brilliant explanations, he was sentenced to death. And he was even asked at his trial, "So Socrates, you will have to die by drinking hemlock." That was the means of execution in those days. Hemlock is a poison. So one would be placed in prison, and on the appointed day, the cup of hemlock would be brought to him, and he would have to drink it. So he was asked, "When you drink the hemlock and you die, how do you want to be buried? In what way shall we dispose of you?" And Socrates said, "You can dispose of me if you can catch me." Robert always appreciated that very much. He meant to say that if you mean me, that means the soul. So you can dispose of me, bury me or burn me or whatever you want to do, if you can catch me. And as far as the body is concerned, who cares anyway? This was his attitude. So Socrates' disciple, he had many disciples, but his most famous disciple was Plato. So Plato wrote down all the teachings of Socrates. That's how we know them today. So Plato's, one of his very famous works is called The Last Days of Socrates, in which he describes his trial and he describes how Socrates met his end, the end of this body anyway, by drinking the hemlock. So on that last day, Socrates was preaching about the soul. He was, all his disciples, Socrates was married, so he had a wife. She was there too. And she was crying, and his disciples were all, some of them were crying, and some were trying to stop from crying. And Socrates was saying, "Why are you crying?" And he was explaining to them very nicely about the soul and about how he was actually welcoming death as release. Socrates was not only situated in Atmagyan, knowledge of the soul, but he knew something about God too. At least we could say he was super soul realized, because he used to say that what I speak comes from within, from the Lord within me. He said, "Throughout my whole life, I have been guided from within, so that when I was faced with an opportunity to do right or wrong, if I would even think of doing something wrong, this voice, this presence within my heart would say, 'No, Socrates, you cannot do this.'" And I always, he said, the difference between myself and other men is that I would always listen to that voice. I would always follow. So Socrates was telling them, "By the grace of God, I will meet God after the end of this body. So why do you lament like this?" So his explanations were very brilliant and convinced everyone there, except two persons. One was named Simmias, who is a follower of a system of philosophy called the Pythagorean system. There's a mathematics. Pythagorean mathematics is known today. So Pythagoras was a mystic who lived long before Socrates. He is associated with Egypt. He's said to have lived in Alexandria or someplace. Cairo, I don't know, Egypt anyway. So he was very much into mathematics and harmonics and balance of equals and all these sorts of things, like many people are today. So Simmias was a Pythagorean. And then there was another person named Cebes. So both of them said to Socrates, "Although we find your words very persuasive, and certainly we do agree with some of the points you're making, this point that you're making, this main point, that we should not lament for you, because you will live on after death. That we cannot accept. So this is an example here. I just want to bring us back to this verse for a moment. Shrutvapinam veda nachayva kashchit. The soul is such, the subject of the soul is so amazing to people who are caught up in material consciousness that even after they hear about the soul from one who is realized in the soul, these people who are absorbed in the gross body, they fail to understand. So these two persons, Simias and Sebes, they could not understand even after hearing Socrates explain so nicely. So both of them, Socrates asked them, so you please explain to me what your objections are to what I have said. What is your philosophical standpoint? So they both put forward some arguments. And it's interesting that their arguments can be... We can discuss them in the light of some verses of the Bhagavad Gita. So for Simeus, we can turn to chapter 2, text 17. Krishna says here, that which pervades the entire body, you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. Now what's interesting is that Simeus, he accepted part of this statement, the first part. Just like both Simeus and Sebes, they said to Socrates, some of what you say, we accept, but not the conclusion. So Krishna here is saying that the soul pervades the entire body. But then the conclusion is, you should know it to be indestructible. So Simeus accepted that there's a soul and that it pervades the entire body. But he could not accept that it's indestructible because he was a follower of Pythagoras. And in this Pythagorean idea of the soul, the body is a composite of balances. There are so many different factors in the body, and they all are balanced very, very finely. So, the Pythagoreans take that very balance to be the soul. And they make a comparison, like a musical instrument. A violin, for instance. So what is a violin? It's an arrangement of wood and ivory and strings. And then when the violin is properly tuned, then there's that mysterious quality that you can say incorporeal quality. It is not a physical quality. So you see the Pythagoreans accept that the soul is not physical. So when an instrument is finely tuned, that quality of being tuned, when you pluck the string, a certain note is sounded. So that is invisible, incorporeal, and it is also splendid. And for those who like music, they will say, it is divine. Very beautiful. Yes, so they will agree with all these points. It is so nice. But when the instrument breaks, you see, if the violin is broken, if the strings pop out of the frame, then the tuning is finished forever. So this was his argument, that which we call soul, yes, it is there, it is invisible, it is incorporeal, it cannot be found in anything physical, and yet at the same time, it depends, its existence depends upon the fine tuning of the body. And when the body is finished, the soul is finished. So that was Simeus' argument. And then Sebes, he had an argument which pertains to the 22nd verse of Bhagavad Gita. This verse reads, as a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, The soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So Sebes agreed with that. He said, yes. He said, the soul throughout the life, just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that Kumaram Yovanam Jara, we're accepting youthful bodies, or child body, then youth body, and then old body. So Sebes said, yes. So similarly, the soul is accepting a succession of bodies in this life. But then he said, actually he was using this very same analogy. He said, just like a human being in his life, he's putting on clothes, and the clothes are wearing out, or he's getting tired of them or whatever, and then he's changing his clothes. He's putting on new clothes. And throughout his life, he's changing his clothes. But at the end of his life, he dies. And then he doesn't put on any more clothes. So Sebes said, so just like that, the soul is moving through a succession of bodies. And the soul is indeed outliving, because the soul is powerful. So the soul is outliving one body after another. But at some point in the life, the soul itself dies, and then you don't see the soul taking on any more bodies. Clever, huh? Actually, it was so clever that all the people in the room, except for Socrates, they were amazed by these arguments. And they said to Socrates, Socrates, we were convinced by everything you were saying, but now that we heard these two, we've lost all of our faith. This shows what kind of people he was teaching. So then, this work is very humorous, actually, the last days of Socrates. So anyway, Socrates, he engages in some joking, and some patting of heads. Oh, you're a good boy to come up with such nice arguments. And then he proceeded to smash them completely in just a few words. So the way he took care of the first argument about the tuning of the instrument, the comparison between the finely tuned instrument and the balances within the body, is that he asked Simmias, so clearly from your example, then that which you call the soul is totally subordinate to the body, isn't it? Just like the tuning of an instrument depends on the instrument entirely. The way the physical setup of the instrument is done, and that will depend on the tuning. There's no independence of this which you call soul from the body. And Simmias, he agreed. So then Socrates asked him, then how do you explain the soul's exertion against the dictates of the body? For instance, even in not even to discuss about those who are on the spiritual path, endeavoring to control their senses for spiritual advancement, even among the sense enjoyers, even among the karmis, they, when they are hungry, due to whatever reasons, even it may be he's just working at his job and his stomach is rumbling, but he controls it. He says, no, I can't eat now. I have to wait till the lunch hour. Otherwise, I may lose my job. I'm not supposed to eat. And in some other case, even among materialists, he may be sleepy, but he forces himself to stay awake. And someone may be lusty, desiring sex, but he cannot do it because he's on the bus. And all kinds of people standing there. So he has to wait till he gets home. And someone else, for some reason, the urge is there, the bodily response is there to defend oneself because he's just been slapped in the face. But he controls himself. Don't do anything, because the person who slapped him is twice as big as him. And it will grind him up into a pulp if he even says anything funny. So he just stands there very calmly. So even among materialists, they control the tendencies of the body. Mm-hmm. So if the soul, if the consciousness is completely subordinate to the body, then how is that possible? For instance, we don't see an instrument tuning itself. We may have a nicely tuned violin, but there's no way that the violin did that itself. Obviously, it's some conscious entity picked up the violin and turned the keys and plucked the strings and got it in the right tune. It is actually through consciousness that we appreciate that an instrument is tuned or not tuned. So consciousness is actually opposing the nature of the body, even among materialists. In order for material society to go on, the consciousness of even the karmis, it has to, for the most part, you'll see if you examine what's going on, for the most part, the karmis are opposing their bodily urges. For the most part. They have to. Otherwise, how will life go on? Just like, you know, yesterday we were riding from Italy, from Milano, and we came from the temple in Bergamo, to Milano to give a class, and then to come to Germany. So we left the temple very early, before 6:30, and the autostrada was full of cars. It wasn't even light. I was riding with a devotee named Haridevan. We were talking about this. How? Just see, these are karmis. And you know, probably half of these people on the road right now, they were up until, you know, 1-2 in the morning last night, drinking and dancing and who knows what they were doing. But because they have to go to work, they force themselves to get up. The body certainly doesn't want to. But they force themselves to get up and they get in the car and they're driving on the autostrada. So then what to speak of someone on the spiritual path who is controlling the urges of the body completely, just like in Krishna consciousness. No meat eating under any circumstances. No illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, ever. So this is done by the soul, by the consciousness. So therefore, Simmias, he had to agree that the soul has to be more than just the balances of the body. Because if it was only something under the control of the body, then whatever the body desired, whatever urges appeared within the body, they would be carried out immediately. Then, for the next argument, by Sebes, Socrates had a real interesting dialectic. So he asked Sebes, "Is fire hot?" Sebes said, "Yes." "Is snow cold?" He said, "Yes, snow is cold." "And are fire and snow opposites in quality?" That means to say, if you bring fire and snow together, if you build a fire in, you know, layouts, make a fireplace out in a snowy field and light the fire, will the snow become hot? Will you see hot snow? Or will you see cold fire? He said, "No." So they're absolutely opposite. They cannot coexist. The qualities of fire and the quality of snow can never coexist, is it not? So Sebes had to agree. Then Socrates said, he asked Sebes, "So, now, what of this body? Are the elements of this body..." We're just talking about the constituent elements of this body. "Are they dead?" And he had to admit, "Yes, they're dead." And then he asked, what brings life to the body? And because he did accept the soul, but under his own terms, that the soul can die. And then he said, well, the soul brings life to the body. And then Socrates asked, so, but still, the body remains, the elements of the body remain dead, is it not? And he said, yes. So, the soul and the body are always distinct, and they're always opposite, is it not? Yes. So, then Socrates asked, so the body and soul are opposite, and you've said that the body, the elements of the body are always dead. Yes. And you've said that the soul brings life to the body. Yes. So wouldn't you conclude that therefore the soul must also be always alive? If they're opposite in every way? And Sivas had to say, yes. Logically, you're right, Socrates. So when the soul leaves the body is a lump of dead matter, is it not? Which rots away and transforms into other material forms, earth, and so on. Yes. So what of the soul? Wouldn't you agree that the soul must continue to exist? Yes, Socrates, I have to agree. So in this way, Socrates, simply by common sense, he established that the soul, being alive, must always be alive, just as the body, being dead, is always dead. This is common sense. But the problem is, the difficulty people have in understanding this, is that because of lust, they want the body to be the living self. Because they want to enjoy. Now, who are they? They are the soul. They are the life force. They are the consciousness. But they want to enjoy matter, which is dead. So in order to do this, they have to think of themselves as dead matter. But because they're alive, they can't think of themselves as dead. So they think of that matter is alive. The body is actually the life itself. Now, as soon as you entertain the dead material elements are actually alive, then if you have also in your philosophy, your strange hodgepodge philosophy, some idea of soul, as soon as you can think that the body is actually alive, then you can also entertain that the soul may die, isn't it? Because you've created one illogical equation by your lusty desire, so that automatically creates another. That the soul, the consciousness, may die. So this is due to lust. And Prabhupada here also, in the purport, says that people who identify with the body, they cannot understand how the soul can be great and small. Prabhupada gave examples of how the atomic soul is within the body of a gigantic animal, in the body of a gigantic banyan tree, and also in the microbic germs, millions and billions of which occupy only an inch of space. So they find this amazing. This makes them disbelieve in the soul, or makes the soul something that is just beyond their comprehension. And the fact is, the soul is beyond that comprehension that they're using. Because in Bhagavad Gita 2.18, also in this chapter, Krishna uses a term for the soul, aprameya. Aprameya means immeasurable. A soul cannot be measured. Antavanta ime deha. the material bodies, deha, antavanta, that has an end. Now in this verse, it means an end in time. These bodies will perish. But also anta can refer to end in space. So the bodies have their existence measurable in time, but also measurable in space. So we see, as Prabhupada mentions here, some very great bodies, elephant body, banyan tree, and very small bodies. So this is all prameya. This is all measurement. Measurement pertains, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj said in a magazine interview in India, that maya, he gave this definition for the word maya. Maya means measurable. So anything that can be measured, you see, with instruments, measured with meter stick or whatever, or weighed, any type of measure that means it's maya, means it's material. And as far as the soul, it's aprameya, it's immeasurable. It's immeasurable in the sense that it's eternal, cannot be measured by units of time, as this body can be. And it's also immeasurable in terms of size. Now, someone may say, but the soul is described as atomic in size. Yes, smaller than the smallest, immeasurably small. This example of taking a hair, the tip of a hair, and dividing it into 100 parts, and then dividing each one of those parts into 100. Prabhupada explains that it is to illustrate that the soul is immeasurably small. Just like Krishna is immeasurably great. But the point is both are immeasurable. So immeasurable means it cannot be understood in terms of these measurable bodies. So the soul, the consciousness of the soul, can pervade as great or as small a body as you like to give it. The body of Brahma, it is said that the whole universe is the width of, I think, something like 7 hands of Lord Brahma. That information is given in Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's how big Brahma is. And then there's the, of course, microbic germs. So this jiva its consciousness can pervade any body you like within creation. Why? Because it is fundamentally immeasurable. But this jiva is called anu, immeasurably small. Whereas the Lord, Krishna, is called vibhu. He is immeasurably great. So from the bodies of, from the pores of the body of Lord Mahavishnu, he's streaming countless universes. Any one universe is beyond our power of comprehension. Today's scientists, with all of their telescopes and instruments, have failed to find the limit of this universe. So any one of these universes is beyond our comprehension. What to speak of trying to understand how there are a limitless number of universes. And they're all coming out of the pores of Mahavishnu. So this is inconceivable. So this is another point here. Srila Prabhupada says that there are those who hear about the soul. They attend lectures in good association, but sometimes owing to ignorance, they are misguided by acceptance of the supersoul and the atomic soul as one without distinction of magnitude. Now this is another point here, that such persons have become a little acquainted with the soul, but now they're amazed about the supersoul. In other words, understanding the soul is one thing, but then understand where everything comes from, where this existence, this vast material existence, what the origin is, how it is maintained. That is amazing. So they become amazed and bewildered by that. And so in their bewilderment, they may wrongly assume that somehow the soul, the individual soul, is responsible for the origin, the maintenance, and the destruction of the entire cosmic manifestation. But the point is this amazement, this bewilderment, this in itself is the evidence of the distinction between the soul and the super soul. Because as far as Krishna is concerned, Bhagavatam says he is avismita, avismitam tam. Avismitam tam purnakama. He is paripurna, avismitam tam paripurnakamam. Svena labhena. So he is, first of all, avismita means he is never amazed by anything. Because Krishna is perfectly situated in complete knowledge of everything. So there's nothing to surprise Krishna. Paripurna kamam. All of his desires, kama means desires, they fulfill themselves. Krishna has a name, Satya Sankalpa. Means as soon as he has a desire, it is fulfilled. In other words, whatever Krishna's desires are, that is what we call reality. There's not even a microscopic difference between Krishna's desires and that which what is. So he is paripurna kamam. All of his desires, they're fulfilled in and of themselves. Svinaiva labhena samam. So he is completely satisfied in his own transcendental glories. He is samam. He is always equipoised and prashanta. Prashanta means he is supremely peaceful, supremely satisfied. Why? Simply because he's Krishna. This is Krishna. This is why the jiva is not Krishna. And that's a fact. As far as the jiva is concerned, there's only one way for the jiva to become shanti, to become peaceful, to become satisfied. And that is to become Krishna bhakta. Krishna bhakta sak, Krishna bhakta nishkama. Yes. Sa, what is that? Atta eva shanta. Yes. Krishna bhakta nishkama atta eva shanta. Because the Krishna bhakta, because he's a devotee of Krishna, he's taken shelter of Krishna. Therefore, he has surrendered all his desires to Krishna. This is the meaning of taking shelter of Krishna. Prabhupada explained it once very nicely. He said it's just like when a son is surrendered to the father. The son may have desires, but he makes no endeavor to fulfill them outside of his dependence upon the father. So the son may go to the father. Prabhupada gave a nice example here. He said, the son may have a desire, small son may have a desire to see a certain film. New Arnold Schwarzenegger film is playing in town. So the son would like to see this film. But he goes to the father and he says, my dear father, there's a new Schwarzenegger film in town. May we go see it? And if the father says, yes, we can go, then the son is very happy to go. And he goes under the protection of the father. And he's actually taken care of completely by the father. The father brings in the son, says, would you like some popcorn? Oh, yes, then let us take popcorn. So the father provides everything. And they enjoy the film together. And actually for the son, the film becomes much more enjoyable. He enjoys to see that father is enjoying this film. It was my suggestion, the son is thinking. It was by my suggestion that we came into this movie house, and I'm so happy to see that father likes the film. So the son is enjoying, but he's enjoying doubly. Because the Father is also enjoying. So his satisfaction is so much greater. So this is a good son. Of course, bad son, then he may not ask the Father at all, or if the Father says no, then he breaks into the piggy bank, steals some money, goes to the theater anyway, comes back and gets caught. That happened to me once when I was about 7 years old. I wanted to see one cowboy film. My parents didn't want me to see it. So somehow I got some money and I went and saw it anyway. And when I came back, because some friend of mine had also been at the showing of the film. So when I came back, I came back with a friend and we were talking about the film. And I forgot. I was so absorbed in talking about the film that I walked into my house with a friend and we were talking about the film. And my mother was there and she was listening to us. And she said, "So you saw this film anyway, did you?" And then I was in trouble. So that's what happens. When the living entity separates his desires from Krishna, then he's in trouble. So surrendering to Krishna means to surrender the desires, and therefore one becomes nishkama. Krishna bhakta nishkama. Then he has no desires of his own. His own desires are